Liberating the Exiled Child. Peter ran an oncology service at a prestigious academic medical center that was consistently rated as one of the best in the country. As he sat in my office in perfect physical shape because of his regular squash practice, his confidence had crossed the line into arrogance. This man certainly did not seem to suffer from PTSD. He told me he just wanted to know how he could help his wife to be less touchy. She had threatened to leave him unless he did something about what she termed his callous behavior. Peter assured me that her perception was warped, because he obviously had no problem being empathetic with sick people. He loved to talk about his work, proud of the fact that residents and fellows competed fiercely to be on his service, and also of scuttlebutt he'd heard about his staff being terrified of him. He described himself as brutally honest, a real scientist, someone who just looked at the facts and, with a meaningful glance in my direction, did not suffer fools gladly. He had high standards, but no higher than he had for himself, and he assured me that he didn't need anybody's love, just their respect. Peter also told me that his psychiatry rotation in med school had convinced him that psychiatrists still practiced witchcraft, and his one stint in couples therapy had further confirmed that opinion. He expressed contempt for people who blamed their parents or society for their problems. Even though he had had his own share of misery as a child, he was determined never to think of himself as a victim. While Peter's toughness and his love for precision appealed to me, I couldn't help but wonder if we would discover something I'd seen all too often. That internal managers who are obsessed with power are usually created as a bulwark against feeling helpless. When I asked him about his family, Peter told me that his father ran a manufacturing business. He was a Holocaust survivor who could be brutal and exacting, but he also had a tender and sentimental side that had kept Peter connected with him and that had inspired Peter to become a physician. As he told me about his mother, he realized for the first time that she had substituted rigorous housekeeping for genuine care. But Peter denied that this bothered him. He went to school and got straight A's. He had vowed to build a life free of rejection and humiliation, but, ironically, he lived with death and rejection every day. Death on the oncology ward, and the constant struggle to get his research funded and published. Peter's wife joined us for the next meeting. She described how he criticized her incessantly, her taste in clothes, her child-rearing practices, her reading habits, her intelligence, her friends. He was rarely at home and never emotionally available. Because he had so many important obligations and because he was so explosive, his family always tiptoed around him. She was determined to leave him and start a new life unless he made some radical changes. At that point, for the first time, I saw Peter become obviously distressed. He assured me and his wife that he wanted to work things out.